some logistical problems. Catering department apparently did not have the proper time for the committee's meeting. But we have before us today the governor of the Reserve Bank, Mr. Mboweni, and his team. He's with Mr. Johan van Heever, who is the head of the research department. We had requested that he comes to brief us on the annual economic report of 2007. But members will be aware that there are quite a number of other documents that are already in Parliament. The most important one being the monetary policy review, which the governor has indicated that he would also want to walk the committee through, and we have agreed that it's going to be the case. And again, also on logistical issues, we will be getting the hard copy of the presentation as we proceed, but members do have the annual economic report before them. We will proceed once copies have been made of both the presentations. So without wasting time, welcome Governor and Mr.
Thank you very much. We are indeed very pleased to be back in the House, interacting with the committee, which is something that, you know, we welcome very much. And this time maybe it's even more crucial because it will look like I'm losing lots of friends around the country. But at least I am consolidating my relationship with the pensioners that I stay with at my apartment in Johannesburg. They are very pleased. Now, we thought we'll respond to the request that was made to us by the committee to discuss the annual economic report, but secondly, to discuss with the committee the monetary policy review, which is kind of the latest analysis by the bank on what is happening to the economy. As we speak this morning, members of the Monetary Policy Committee are going around the country discussing the monetary policy, explaining why it is that the cost of borrowing has tightened. And we have accountability for that. So they're going around the country. And I think it's therefore important that this committee is also kept abreast of what these members are saying around the country, and that the monetary policy review. So I've asked the head of the research department, Johan van Heever, to walk us through the annual economic report, but very briefly. But take a little bit more time with the monetary policy review. I think it will help. In the bank, they call him Morena Johan. You know, he speaks really much better than I do. South African. So, if it's in order with you,
we'll get Mr. Moloto to confirm his language skills during the tea break.
Absolutely.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This presentation will then first touch on the annual economic report, which was released on the 20th of September, and then on the monetary policy review. So for a start, just some background regarding the annual economic report. That is more a longer-term orientation. What is the broad economic context within which South African monetary policy is conducted? And it looks a bit more at longer-term trends and not at the latest 6 months or the latest 3 months. This presentation will then be very brief. As the governor indicated, some of the drafts have been updated beyond what was available in September. And I think the one message of this annual economic report, of which you probably have the hard copies available, is that we have had quite a few exceptional record levels for a number of variables, which makes it all a very exciting period, not just for us, but in the world economy. So for the world economy as a whole, real economic growth has been quite good. The past 3 years or so have really been quite positive. And what's also quite encouraging is that for most countries, those growth rates have been more consistent and not so much up and down. Not 1% the 1 year and 8% the next year and again 1%. The range of growth rates has narrowed down quite a bit, which helps for a kind of a smoother world economy as things develop. And on the inflation front also, and if you go back to the 1980s and 1990s, we had terrible episodes of high inflation. World inflation is now quite low, and also the outliers there are really quite few. So this blue area on this graph is actually a trimmed area where the outliers right at the top and right at the bottom have been thrown out. But for the 75% of countries in the middle, inflation is very tame and in a kind of a very nice small range, so that predictability has improved quite a bit. In South Africa, we have a bit of the same story as far as our growth is concerned. We've had 4 years now, more or less, of growth not far from 5% per annum in real terms, and that has made for improved living standards and very nice momentum. It has also made for capacity utilization in manufacturing and in the economy overall being relatively high. And that in turn has contributed, I think, to more fixed investment. As manufacturers and people in electricity generation and in whatever other areas of the economy discover that they are now at close to full capacity or right at full capacity, they have little choice but to expand, and so they are investing quite a bit. But this has been one of the, I think, main messages, that over the past 4 years or so, domestic expenditure has really been stronger than domestic production. So we are, in a way, buying more, including those capital goods, than we are producing. And for that reason, of course, we are also running balance of payments deficits on the current account. But this is then the important expenditure component, final consumption expenditure by households. That's the red line on this graph. And this one really shows that lately there's been a bit of a moderation in consumption expenditure. But if you look at those numbers, though, it's still numbers of now 5%. Now, down from, say, 7% or 7.5%, it's still really quite strong growth in consumption expenditure in the most recent half year. In this process of strong consumption expenditure, there has been an accumulation of household debt, as I'm sure the committee is well aware of, numbers in excess of 75, even 76% most recently. The debt service cost ratio has also moved up alongside the higher debt levels, but also alongside the higher interest rates which are applied to those outstanding debt levels. Fixed capital formation. Yes. Well, I think it's important to note that the household debt ratio currently is really at an all-time high, standing at more than 76% of annual income. The debt service cost, though, if one looks at that, it's not at an all-time record high. If one goes back in time, in 2002, it came close to where it currently is, and in 1998, of course, it went way above to 14% as far as debt service cost relative to income is concerned. So at that point, the, say, average household was paying 14% of income towards just paying interest on debt, not even to repay capital. Now, that was really very tight. Now, things have tightened in this recent cycle, but it is still actually not quite as exciting and painful as the 1998-99 episode was, when those interest rates went up to really high levels. At some point, the prime rate went to levels above 25%. I think 25.5% was the highest. So, relative to that, it is still not an excessively burdensome debt service cost, which is shown on this graph.
If I may explain,
if you look at the graph very closely,
there's a very interesting phenomenon that one can pick up. You see that when interest rates were high in 98 through to 2001, household debt as a percentage of household disposable income was coming down. You can see the graph was coming down as interest rates were high then. But from about 2003 or 2002, basically, when interest rates were lower, you see an unbelievable climb in the household debt as a percentage of household disposable income, which is quite sad, because what should have happened is that as interest rates came down, households should have been repaying their debt and not increasing it. But instead, what has happened is that people took more debt because interest rates were low. You can see the graph that is starting to shoot up like that, which is the wrong way, going the wrong direction. We should have been using the opportunity of low interest rates to repay our debt and not to accumulate more debt. But what happened is that we have been accumulating more debt, and we begin to see the pickup as well slowly in the bottom graph, which is the debt service. And this is very difficult to explain, but it's just a human phenomenon. When money is cheap, we take on more debt rather than paying off whatever debt that we have. It's just a human phenomenon, which is difficult to explain. Whenever I speak to students who are studying economics, I always advise them to also study psychology. It might help. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be some discussion on this from the committee, but we'll deal with it when the time for engagement with the committee comes. That slide, members, is on page 14, and that's where the story is, but we'll get back to it.
As far as fixed capital formation is concerned, or fixed investment, that's really at a now quite high and juicy level, more than 20% of gross domestic product. So that's a sign then of the full capacity coming closer, and more, I think, encouragement, confidence in the economy by both households and by business people, which is then all in all, I think, a happy outcome. The green line, which is so strong on this graph, is parastatals. So, and in particular, Eskom played quite a bit of a role in these latest pretty high numbers which are observed. But more generally, the public sector fixed capital programs are progressing nicely, and the private sector is not that far behind. They're also quite strong. On the balance of payments side, just so that we know that we're not alone in having a current account deficit. The United States has these very large deficits. This graph is a long one, a long-run one going back to 1980, and one can see how the U.S. current account deficit has widened up over time. For South Africa, this red line on this graph shows our own current account deficit. Oh, and that's been around about 6.5% of gross domestic product. Most recently has been our current account deficit, so we are importing more than we are exporting. Part of the story there is that whereas the prices of our commodity exports went up quite favorably, that is shown in the red line on this graph, going up so strongly, the volumes of production and exports of commodities did not go up quite as strongly. In some other countries in the world, like Australia, actually that quantity response has been sharper, stronger than what we have been observing. But nevertheless, our quantities have actually risen, and the prices are quite good, and that has helped to support our export proceeds quite nicely. On the other hand, given the strong boom in consumption and in investment, our imports have been strong because we import much of those consumer goods and investment goods, capital goods, and so our import ratio and import volumes have been rising quite a bit. Now, of course, to finance all of that, because we are now importing more than what we are exporting, we have fortunately been able to attract money from abroad. Our foreign debt has actually increased, mainly because of portfolio investments, so non-residents who purchase South African bonds and the like on the South African bond market, bring money into the country in that way. One should just always remember that they do not invest here out of generosity. They want to make a return on those investments. And so because our foreign debt levels have gone up in this way at least, the interest paid on that debt has also gone up quite a bit. So the terms of trade is the bottom line in this graph, and that has been favorable to South Africa. So the terms of trade is our export prices divided by our import prices. Our export prices have been going up more than our import prices, despite the bad luck we've had with the oil price. And so, all in all, we have benefited on balance because of price effects. So those prices of platinum and gold, for instance, they really had a wonderful run. And for our whole basket of exports then, the prices have gone up more than what our import prices have gone up. And that is to the benefit of South Africa's living standards. This shows the financial transactions on the balance of payments. Now, where the current account, the imports and exports of goods, was in deficit, on the financial account we have had nice surpluses. Actually, the surpluses shown here for the first half of 2007 was in excess of 8% of GDP. Current account deficit, perhaps between 6 and 7% of GDP. So we've actually managed to get more money flowing into the country through the financial account than what was flowing out through the current account. And so that made it possible for the South African Reserve Bank to add to its foreign exchange reserves. And we are really now in a far less vulnerable position, more robust, with levels of our foreign reserves likely in excess of $30 billion. This just shows what's been happening to loans and advances of the banking sector. It's part of that same debt story, that people's appetite for incurring more debt has been whetted quite nicely by the favorable economic circumstances and the, until recently, quite a bit lower interest rates. And so we have been witnessing rates of increase of more than 20%, 25% even, for loans and advances extended by the banking sector. This is perhaps just something to note on the list of records broken in the recent past. Just about every year over the past 3 years, the South African share prices set new record levels. Every time there's a hiccup, as there was this year in February with some concerns related to China, and then again in August related to the U.S. subprime market, each time there's a bit of a setback, but then it seems there's again a recovery. And so on balance, so far at least, share prices have been kind to South African owners of shares, and those prices have really gone to extremely favorable levels, implying lots of positive wealth effects for those owners of shares. And I think I'd like to highlight this graph on the housing market, which shows that house price increases, despite the higher interest rate levels recently, continue to go up quite a bit. The top blue line shows that those year-on-year increases in house prices went as high as 35% about 3 years ago. Currently, it's perhaps closer to 14 or 15%. The green line shows that the real interest rate on mortgage advances has been negative for quite a while. In other words, the house price appreciation in recent years was actually more than the interest you had to pay on the loan to obtain the house. And that's one of the reasons, perhaps, why people had so much appetite to incur debt. It was quite rational to buy a house, see it appreciate by 20%, pay just 10% interest on the loan against that house, so your balance sheet is strengthened in that process. Now, just recently, that green line shows, though, that with the current setting of interest rates and the current tempo of house price increases, there seems to be no longer that strong negative home mortgage rate in real terms. It's now gone to more or less a break-even rate on that basis, at least. There's just an interim conclusion then on the broad economic situation, that the international environment is fairly favorable, but not without risk and turbulence, and so on. But I think let me rather move on quickly to the monetary policy review and introduce that.
Let me just check whether members perhaps wanted to ask questions on the economic annual economic report, so that when we get on to the monetary policy review, we'll deal with it separately. But, I mean, members, let's combine the two, or let's combine the two. Go ahead.
Then the monetary policy review released last week, where I think this is now a shorter term context, reviewing basically the past 6 months. Of course, what was exciting over the past 6 months was that we have actually witnessed inflation rates above the target level. After a spell of about 3.5 years of CPI ex inflation being within the target of 3 to 6%, we have had over the past number of months values above that. It started from April this year, and that has been, of course, in a way, additional pressure on monetary policy. Now, this pressure originated from exogenous forces. In other words, it came from things which are largely outside the short-term control of the South African authorities, basically prompted by the oil price, which has been extremely unfavorable, and also some shocks from food prices, which are not entirely unrelated to the oil price, of course. But despite this then being an exogenous shock to the inflation process, the thing is not to let that shock last, and so this breach of the inflation target is of concern to the South African Reserve Bank. And the mandate remains to get inflation back to within the target. So, in May 2007, of course, we are already close to that situation of inflation being in unacceptable territory. Some of the key inflation risks have proved to be persistent, such as the oil price. And there has also been quite a bit of volatility, as shown in that previous graph on the subprime crisis and the share market. We've really had interesting times in the world financial markets. At the same time, there are some signs that the South African economy is responding to the changes which have been made to the monetary policy stance. Of course, we should always just be mindful of the lags in monetary policy, where we usually think of monetary policy as having a cumulative impact on the economy, and it actually takes 12 to 24 months before the interest rate medicine has really fully worked through to the economy. In this monetary policy review, there are also a number of boxes, but members could perhaps interrogate that afterwards during question time. I won't be dealing with them in any detail in this short presentation. But then just emphasize the recent developments in inflation. You would have seen in the annual economics report the graphs dealing with inflation I hid away, And so let's talk to that one right now. CPIX inflation, as this graph shows on the red line, is currently in unfavorable territory, 6.7%. It moved up to 6.3%, if I remember correctly, in April, and it has been above the 6% mark ever since. The headline CPI inflation is slightly higher than that. Headline inflation, of course, also includes the interest on mortgage bonds, and because interest rates have been increased quite a bit, that's then the reason why headline CPI inflation is currently a bit higher than CPIX inflation. And then, of course, the food prices really played a significant role in pulling that CPIX inflation rate up. As you will see, for all food items, we here observe inflation rates in excess of 10%. Now, food prices are fairly important in the overall scheme of things for CPIX inflation, a weight close to a quarter of the total basket. So food price inflation has really pulled up this red line in a quite miserable way. This graph shows some more detail on where the food price inflation is strongest. It so happens that just most recently, vegetables have been quite disappointing, and also grain products have also been quite disappointing. Now, to some extent, this grain product inflation has to do with the biofuels related programs in the world, which has led to many types of grain and other produce that can be used to produce a substitute for oil and petroleum observing prices pretty sky high. And so this has had some fallout also in the South African wholesale price level and also on the retail prices of food and grain products. Now, just recently, incidentally, it seems that meat price inflation has decelerated, but it's not to say that meat prices have come down. They're just going up at a less rapid tempo than before. At the highest, though, late last year, meat prices were rising as rapidly as 20% year on year, which was clearly to the detriment of hungry consumers. This little table shows the contributions of the various components to overall CPIX inflation.
I think the previous graph on about CPIX and food inflation is very important because it explains quite a lot. You can see the contributions of the various categories of foods. If you look at the blue line, for example, green, which is vegetables, as you were saying, you see the strong increase in the prices, the strong rate of increase in the prices of vegetables, which is something that should be of concern, because, you know, it's what people eat. And those members who are like me, they go to the shops to buy vegetables, would have noticed the unbelievable increase in the price of cabbage. The price of cabbage has just shot up unbelievably. So I don't know what has happened to the cabbage growers. And, you know, because I like cabbage. I grew up eating cabbage, so I still do even today eat a lot of cabbage. And then you look at milk products and eggs, which is the blue line. You also see this double pressure, which, you know, has an impact on the lives of ordinary people. And then grain products, obviously, then that will come to mealy and other products which are used for cooking hummus. It's going up. So overall, you can see that there's really some strong pressure on food prices. Now, I do not have all the information which might explain all of this, but Johan mentioned some of the factors. But I think we should be concerned when we read reports about whether the pricing system is competitive or not, something which I think this committee must take up with some of the wholesalers and some of the producers. Because the report that I saw yesterday was quite disturbing that, you know, some companies might have been fixing the bread price inappropriately. So is it just the bread price, or is it just overall people just having a free day out there? I'm not suggesting at all, and I think I totally disagree with the view that you must fix prices. That's bad news, bad economics. But there must be something I'm sure that this committee can do by visiting these companies and getting the details and sorting out some of the pricing tendencies. So this is a really serious problem that I think we're facing. I thought I should just highlight that.
One of the contributing factors, of course, must have been that this year we did not produce enough maize domestically for the full domestic needs or consumption of maize. And for that reason, the prices of maize have moved up to import parity, which is quite a bit higher than export parity in a normal year when we produce enough for the whole of South Africa and a little bit available for exports, the prices go down a bit. So currently we're facing a world price which is really high because of many reasons, but including biofuels, and at the same time the need to import a little bit of our total consumption, and that was enough to drive our prices up to import parity, which is really quite sky high. Similarly, perhaps for quite a number of other products. And in a normal year, when production is at the level where it should be on average over the long run, fortunately, it's more likely that for grain products, at least, prices will again reflect prices closer to export parity rather than import parity. This graph just shows the most significant contributors to CPIX inflation. Here the numbers go to September, and you would see that of the 6.7% year-on-year inflation for total CPIX, in September, 3.2% came from food. That's the second line in this table. So food was really very important in all of that. It's kind of half of the overall inflation impulse at the moment. The housing cost, similarly, really on the high side. Many costs attached to having a house, including some of the administered components like the rates and so on levied by municipalities have gone up significantly. The other components are also, well, not insignificant, but those two are probably the really main ones to highlight at this point in time. Yes, interestingly enough, that on transport and fuel and power, partly perhaps because of base reasons and because of the exchange rate, which hasn't been too bad, there the year-on-year numbers at least are not too bad. The price levels for petrol and so on, however, are pretty high, that one must acknowledge. But the year-on-year increases have not been that terrible a part of the inflation picture. One should, of course, also remember that the weights of things like food would be quite a bit more than the weight of something like transport and petroleum. But this is then an attempt to disentangle some of these forces driving inflation to get to a more underlying inflation, which is cleared of the exogenous short-term drivers of inflation. So the red line is the familiar headline CPIX inflation, currently at 6.7%. But then those lines down below, the green one and the, I guess, orange-brownish one, they are stripped. The green one excludes food prices. And immediately, as you can see, we actually have numbers which are fairly close to the middle of the inflation target range. And then that brownish, orange-like line excludes both food and energy prices. And again, the latest values there are quite a bit below the 6% mark. So clearly, the bad guy of this story is food, just for the moment. Administered prices, those prices where government has a significant direct influence in...
Sorry, Johan, can I just check that all members have the erasum on page... on page 3, paragraph 2. You don't do that page because the differences are quite huge in the numbers there if we don't have that, that error. Okay, now proceed.
Moving on to this graph, which has the administered prices shown separately, and then the administered price index excluding petrol. Well, one would observe here that at the moment the administered prices index in total is actually just below the 6% mark if one looks at the September year-on-year increase there. If one were to exclude petrol, where we actually had a bit of good luck, I think one finds, however, that those administered prices excluding petrol are close to 7% year-on-year most recently. So, but in a certain way, administered prices, perhaps partly for base reasons, is not currently as destructive a force in the overall picture then as food prices is, just for the moment. Production price inflation... Well, to review what's been happening over the past year there, following the fall in the exchange rate of last year's middle of May, many prices have gone up, and it was more strongly felt in the production prices area, where inflation has accelerated to levels above 10% year on year at the highest points, which were in the early months of this year. It has actually receded slightly to more now than 9 to 10% range most recently because of the exchange rate and a number of other reasons, again including the prices of petroleum products. Then to review the factors affecting inflation, this is just a picture of what happened to inflation. Well, we try to do a roundup of how strong world demand is. If world demand is very robust and strong, then in a certain way it creates an environment where output gaps are smaller and where there is more easily risk of inflation dangers. So yes, well, the short story is that world economic growth in 2006 was quite strong. For 2007, again, overall, it's assessed to be fairly strong still at more than 5%, and that perhaps imparted additional confidence and strength to demand. World inflation, that's then the right hand side of that table. Yes, indeed. Excluding Zimbabwe, world inflation has been quite modest, levels of 3.6% and 3.9%. for 2006 and 2007 respectively. Again, there's a bit of a dispersion, but in all honesty, for most parts of the world, inflation is really in very same territory. There are just a handful of outliers, and as for the rest, it's very, very tame. And as the governor said, Zimbabwe has been stripped out of this equation. So a world general inflation picture, which is not too bad, although there are those concerns about food prices also in other parts of the world, and oil prices. This is then the oil price side. The latest values there, unheard of, levels in excess of even $90 most recently. So each time the price goes up, then it moderates, and just as we start to become enthusiastic and happy, it again accelerates upwards to a new record level. So most recently we have observed record nominal prices of crude oil on planet Earth. Incidentally, on this graph, those lines at the right-hand side show futures prices established in the futures market for oil. The monetary policy environment in the rest of the world during the past 6 months or so, well, it's a bit of a mixed bag. Still actually more countries increasing interest rates on this panel than that were decreasing interest rates. But the United States, for instance, there was quite a change of the scene in the third quarter of this year, when after a long period of a flat line, there was actually a decrease in interest rates, first by a half percentage point and later by a further quarter percentage point in October. So, indeed, at least that major players in the world economy started to reduce interest rates, not least because of, I think, some fragility concerns surrounding the fallout of the subprime crisis. On this second page, which also includes more developing countries, it's a bit more of a mixed bag with both increases and decreases in interest rates most recently. Overall, however, probably a world environment where clearly things are still more strongly against inflation than what it was 3 or 4 years ago, when those American interest rates, for instance, were really extremely, exceptionally low. Another driver of inflation over the past year, which I referred to earlier on, is the exchange rate of the rand. On the top panel, higher means a stronger rand, lower is a weaker rand, and last year in May, as I indicated, that was when the exchange rate really receded quite a bit. All in all, it declined by roughly 20% against the basket of currencies, and that made all imported goods more expensive, of course, and that has contributed to the inflation which we are currently observing. On the labor front, well, there have been interesting ups and downs in remuneration, the way that we calculate it from a quarterly survey. I think there's perhaps a lot of noise in the quarter-to-quarter numbers, and it might actually be more prudent to refer to this graph, which deals with wage settlements as they are surveyed. Now, those wage settlements, which are shown in the blue line over the year, actually have ticked up over the past 2 years, not by a huge amount, but where it was perhaps just above the 6% settlement mark in 2005, it's now just above the 7% mark for the part of 2007 for which we have data so far. So it's still quite tame if one compares it with, say, the early numbers in the 1990s shown on this graph, all the numbers in 2003, which was kind of catch up after some inflation in the previous year. But overall, there is certainly slightly more enthusiasm to have wage increases which are a bit higher than what they were in the previous years. It makes sense to some extent because there's more employment, the economy is closer to full capacity, and in those ways there is perhaps a bit of an enhancement of the bargaining power also of the union movement. If one looks at the expenditure side, what's been happening over the past 6 months, again, just to highlight that household consumption expenditure, there it is still growing, but it's growing a little bit less strongly than before. That 5.5% in the right-hand top corner of this chart is then quite a bit below what it previously was, but it is still fairly strong. General government, very choppy, but because of large purchases such as military equipment, one quarter up, one quarter down. Fixed capital formation, that's been a good story. 14% real growth for the second quarter, 22% almost for the first quarter. So fixed capital formation is still quite strong. That's strong on the demand side, but because it also adds to future capacity, it's actually a good story. And I think then I'd also like to just point out that at least for the second quarter, our exports were growing in real terms, whereas our imports actually, just for that one quarter, actually receded slightly. the house prices, well, I think already showed a previous graph in the previous part of the presentation on that, but numbers of close to 14-15% year on year. The month-to-month numbers, though, in recent months have been actually quite tame, numbers closer to 0.5% or so increase in house prices, which shows that the monetary medicine inter alia must have been having a bit of an impact in the house price formation process too. Share prices, strong, recovered quite a bit after the August-September setbacks. And then the public finance data, again, that area has been supportive of monetary policy, quite a disciplined environment with a budget balance moving into surplus and debt service costs and debt levels which are quite tame. The monetary aggregates, to the extent that inflation is supported by growth in money supply and credit extension, that growth in money supply has been quite high. Numbers have been well in excess of 20% year on year for all of the monetary aggregates. The only thing that's growing slowly at the moment is perhaps notes and coin in circulation, where the numbers have come down to 10% or even 8% year on year. But for the money that people ordinarily use in bank accounts, those deposits have been growing very, very rapidly at rates in excess of 20%, 23%. Those are advances. Yes. Well, M3 is of course the one which I think the committee is used to observe in presentations for a long time. That's the broad money supply. It includes notes and coin in the hands of the public, plus all deposits of households and of South African companies with the South African banking sector. So there's lots of deposits in there, all maturities, up to 20-year deposits, all of it is there, from check deposits right through to very long term. If one looks at the composition of M3, one finds that about 3-4% is notes and coin, and then the other 96% plus would be deposits. So, but now, M2 now throws out long-term deposits. That's deposits with maturities in excess of 6 months. And so M2 is a shorter term version of money supply. And then M1, that's actually notes and coin plus only deposits up to 24 hours notice. So check deposits are there and all other deposits up to 24 hours notice. And so that's in the M1, the narrow money supply. It's more actively used for transactions. Clearly, your long-term deposits you don't use very often to purchase things. It's parked for quite some time. And so for that reason, it's kind of useful to also look at M1. Although this picture says that whether you look at M1, M2, or M3, the picture remains more or less the same. There's fairly rapid money supply growth still at the moment.
Mr. Chairman, I think that is the best professorial
simplified
term. You know, there should be an academic at the University of Pretoria, so that's the best ever experience. Better than the textbook.
Well, then on to the money supplies on the liability side of the bank's balance sheet. On the asset side of the bank's balance sheet is bank loans and advances. This graph shows how that has developed over the past period. Over the past 6 months at least, growth in bank loans and advances remained quite strong. It was, however, a bit of a shift in the pattern. Previously, the really strong one was just mortgage advances. The blue line, which has now softened slightly, it's still growing quite strongly. It's close to 30% still, but down from the previous numbers in excess of 30% where it was in 2006. So there's been a bit of a slowdown, consistent with the house prices, which are no longer going up quite as strongly as before. And then the other line which has shifted up is this red line called other loans and advances. This is now bank advances in the form of company loans, generally, project loans, and the like. Now, it's especially companies that have taken up more loans. And this again is consistent with the strong fixed investment drive which we currently observe. And also inventory investment taking place. So companies need working capital, and a part of that they borrow from the banking system. So that has pulled up this red line to pretty high levels. I do not think that is the type of credit that naturally flows into consumption expenditure. This is really companies borrowing in order to invest. So this is not entirely then a bad inflation story. It can be actually interpreted as very good because it helps to create future capacity to produce more. And then the, let's see, again this light brown line, the one which is the lowest towards the end of the graph, that one has softened quite a bit. Now that is related very much to vehicle finance, and the growth rates of vehicle finance recently have come down quite a bit. It's still in positive territory, but really not rising as briskly as before. So what's been happening to monetary policy? Since 6 months ago, there have been further changes in the stance of monetary policy, and this is shown by this graph. So you will see those three steps in the repo rate and in the prime overdraft rate. The first one in June of this year, the second one in August, the third one in October. Of course, the whole tightening episode started a year earlier in 2006, when those first upward steps were observed June last year, and again then every 2 months up to December. So there were four increases 2006. Then there was a period of sideways movement during the first 6 months of this year, or 5 months of this year, and then the June increase was the next step. So what happened? As usually, the MPC would always focus on getting inflation rate to within the target range. Because we know of the lags between monetary policy changes and inflation reacting to those changes, of course, the MPC can never react just to the latest numbers and adjust policy for that. No, the adjustments had to do with the fact that the expected path of inflation worsened because of some of the drivers and forces in the inflation spiral as it was discussed and analyzed by the Monetary Policy Committee. So, whereas things were still quite favorable in February and in April of this year, with the price of oil, for instance, in the first months of this year being quite favorable, the price of oil came down, by June things had deteriorated quite a bit. The risk to the outlook for inflation would then seem to be strongly on the upside, and there was danger signals in the area of oil prices, food prices, household consumption, which was at that stage still assessed to be very, very strong, and changes in inflation expectations also were going in the wrong direction. So the forecast of the banks also showed further deterioration, and so the repo rate in June of this year was increased. In August, it was pretty much the same story, although then the situation was made more troublesome by the international ups and downs, the financial market jitters, which took hold of the world at that stage. The MPC felt that it was too early to assess the longer-term implications of these financial market jitters observed through the world, and that it would continue to remain focused on the inflation target. And that the MPC would react to financial market developments insofar as they impacted on the inflation outlook only. The unfortunate upside risk to the inflation outlook identified in June remained in place, and there was actually a slight deterioration of the central forecast of future inflation by the bank, and so the repo rate was increased again by another 50 basis points. In October, a bit of the same story. It was observed, honestly, that the economy was starting to respond to the higher interest rates. There was now enough data on consumption, for instance, to say that there's a bit of a softening, but not that much. So again, the challenge now was to assess and balance these considerations, and the view of the NPC was that despite this moderation in some of the inflation drivers and forces, the risk to the outlook was still significantly on the upside. And on balance, it was then decided to adjust the repo rate again upward 50 basis points, 10.5% was the level of the repo rate at the end of this NPC meeting's implementation. Looking now at the outlook for inflation, the world picture for 2008, real growth slightly lower probably than what it was in 2007. Not that we have the full 2007 as hard numbers yet, that's still in the making. World inflation, general views again that 2008 won't be too bad, that the inflation rate will most probably still remain below the 4% mark quite nicely. And for the various countries, you would also observe, for instance, that for Africa, a rate of 6% inflation is foreseen in 2008, actually a bit lower than the 2007 expected rate. The China and India wonders continuing, and Japan, low inflation as always. On the domestic front, the domestic outlook is also for domestic growth to remain robust, all of this momentum, at least the largest bulk of that to be continued. The Reuters consensus forecast and also actually the Treasury forecast actually indicate relatively favorable growth prospects for 2008 and even for 2009. Consumer and business confidence, however, have moderated so far in 2007. They remain, however, strongly in positive territory. It's not as if consumer and business confidence has fallen to danger territory where people say that things are bad. No, but compared to actually very excellent levels of confidence previously, things have moderated, perhaps realistically so. In assessing the outlook for inflation, an important input into that process is looking at inflation expectations as polled by the Bureau of Economic Research. They poll various groups, analysts, business people, and the labor unions, and from those groups, they combine a picture of what views on inflation is. It's interesting that in the latest round of such assessment, the views were that for 2007, inflation will be worse than when it was surveyed previously, but that for 2008 and 2009, despite these numbers not being wonderful, expectations still remained for inflation to remain below the 6% mark. And I think that's quite encouraging. The future inflation view of influential South African analysts, business people, trade unions is still for inflation to go back to within the target range. And this just shows in table form what those numbers are. For instance, the number right at the right bottom shows that the average of these three groupings, their view was that inflation would be 5.6% in 2009. 5.8% in 2008, so that's still reconcilable with where we would like the outcomes to be. The Reuters survey is slightly more up to date, and again there, the mean view for CPIX inflation polled for 2009 is 5.1% for 2009 CPIX inflation. There, of course, one observes that for 2007, the view was numbers in excess of 6%, and probably quite realistically so. Break-even inflation, that's another indicator of inflation expectations. It's calculated by taking the difference between nominal government bond rates and inflation index bond rates. One can prove that that is a proxy for inflation expectations of participants in those bond markets, And interestingly enough, again here, from this market information, one gets readings that the inflation expectation in that market is for the longer run inflation to return to well below the 6% mark. That is the red line on this graph. The shorter term outlook, of course, is a bit more clouded. So for the next year or so, I think that market also expects inflation to be not so favorable. Now, there's lots of ifs and buts to this, not least because this break-even inflation rate is calculated from headline CPI, not CPI X inflation, but nevertheless, the indications are that the overall view on inflation is still moderate. And then the bank's own CPI X inflation forecast presented by way of this fan chart. Now, this graph then shows that as presented to the MPC in October of this year, the central view was that inflation will go higher. The darkest area on that graph actually goes up for a number of quarters and then comes down. And then actually during the course of 2008, in the second half of the year, moves below the 6% mark, and by 2009 moves to levels which are just marginally above the 5% mark. But as you can see, there's a big spread of uncertainty around these central values. So remembering that the tools of economists are not perfect, we are modest enough to allow for lots of uncertainty around this central forecast. But given what we know about monetary policy, about the likely future course of the economy and of exogenous forces, this is the best estimates by bank staff of what inflation will do.
Let me just explain this because just in case there's a misunderstanding. One of the important guiding slogans in economics is ceteris paribus. All things remaining the same. In other words, this forecast is based on what we know today and what we think might happen if all things remain the same. It's a very useful thing because in economics because it helps us to explain ourselves out of trouble. Because if things change, I'm going to come to this committee and say, but things have changed. So therefore this forecast, it can't be this. You can't hang me on the pole based on this because the situation has changed. For example, at the time of this forecast, the oil price had not reached, say, around 100 when these assumptions were made. So things have definitely changed. So ceteris paribus is not always holding. It's a very important thing to bear in mind. Because things move all the time. But this is based on what the staff of the bank has fed into the model. The model itself is a set of mathematical econometric equations, which have got their own faults, but at least, as I indicated before this committee, some guidelines, some signs to guide the art of central bank. But ceteris paribus. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I could also just highlight to this committee that in the interest of transparency, in June of this year, the Reserve Bank actually published the model which is used to generate these forecasts. Published it, it's now available on our website and in paper format, and in many ways, if members are interested, they could just have a look at our website. The governor said it's boring. It could probably only be exciting to econometricians who have lots and lots of time to delve into the deep equations. But at least as a transparency thing, this peer-reviewed model is there for members to inspect or perhaps to disseminate to interested other economists and financial people. And I think to conclude, almost regrettably, The past 6 months have been quite exciting and have been challenging from a monetary policy perspective. It's not, I think, that nice to feel that you're under pressure because the target value has been exceeded. Inflation has deteriorated somewhat, despite the tighter monetary policy stance adopted in 2006. There have been some signs of moderation in consumption expenditure. The outlook for monetary policy will depend to quite a degree on whether these signs of moderation are sustained and sufficient to bring about the desired inflation outcome. So we have to review at each meeting what is happening. Bottom line is that monetary policy in our country will remain focused on getting inflation back to within the inflation target range. Then just to be mindful of the fact that December is approaching, members might be advised that there are some examples in the animal kingdom of how December should perhaps be spent.
That's it, members. We've taken presentations on both the annual economic report and the monetary policy review. Comments, questions? Mr. Mguni, Mr. Mbili, Mr. Marais, Mr. Molojo.
Before the the hand that's surrounding. Maybe just to highlight a few points. The first point to emphasize is that coming out of the meetings of the IMF and the World Bank, one is left with the impression that despite the current difficulties, oil price, food prices, the subprime market, and I'm going to come to that. It's quite all right. The global economy seems to be in a strong footing, which is very encouraging. There might be some slowdown in the U.S. economy, which will have some impact on the global economy, but despite all that, given the strong growth in China and India, the expectation is of good global economic growth. So that's the first one. Second point is that for central bankers, the inflation outlook going forward is still positive despite the persistently high oil prices. It's a very important point because this should give us some indication about what the thought process is like for central bank governors, the most significant of whom will be arriving in Cape Town in the next day or two for the meetings of the G20 online. They were complaining at the airport that they're overwhelmed by the number of central bank governors who are coming to Cape Town for the first time in the history of the country. So those who like celebrities, you know, see someone there. Ben Bernanke included. Logistical problem. But anyway, when we ask whether we want to host the G20 meetings, we raise our hand, which in retrospect, I don't know whether that's a good idea. But the Minister of Finance has a particular view about that. Central bankers will be thinking quite a lot about what to do in this current environment where there's exogenous shocks. Third point is that when one looks at the African economic performance, one cannot help but be encouraged by the major changes which have happened on the African continent. Economic performance is very impressive. Inflation rates have been coming down on the continent. And a point that was made very clear by the IMF's World Economic Report
You just have to exclude Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is a total disaster. Just exclude it. So we'll get into trouble again. But the key issue for Africa is to sort out some of the infrastructural backlogs. Sort out some of the basic services, education, health services. For example, as I've said maybe before this committee before, there's no reason why there can't be any clean drinking water in the Congo. So just the putting in place the water purification plant, and that's it. And maybe when I'm 70 years old and I've retired from the central bank, that's the business I must do. Go and start water purification in the Congo. Maybe you might join me, Mr. Chairman, in that. Finally, let me just say the inflation picture in South Africa, as Dr. van der Heerde showed, is that the pressures are on the upside, whether from electricity, from vegetables, and so on. Pressures on the upside. And as I've indicated somewhere recently, when the focus and the outlook indicates that inflation is likely to stay above the target range until the middle of next year, the task of the central bank is to tighten monetary policy, not to loosen. So, I mean, if I was the only member of the Monetary Policy Committee, I would most certainly increase rates in December. That is, if I was the only member of the committee. I would definitely tighten rates in December because, as you can see, there was a period that the Monetary Policy Committee should have tightened rates but didn't. And I think that might have been an error. And if you look at that, technically it's clear that the Monetary Policy Committee should actually tighten in December. Now, Minister of Finance would say, oh God, you're stealing Christmas away from us. And I'm going to say, well, the government decided on the inflation target. My job is to implement the task. But as you know, I'm not the only member of the Monetary Policy Committee. There are lots of professors there who I'm sure come with all kinds of arguments why things must be done differently. But if I was the only member of the committee, I'll tighten in December. I'm trying to say this so that all the questions which are coming can be sorted out before I in anticipation. But nevertheless, the economy is still robust. I think that from the growth point of view, the economy is still growing slightly above potential. Potential for the South African Reserve Bank is 4.5%. The economy is still growing slightly above potential. That's why we have so many supply constraints in the economy, including cement, as we mentioned before, electricity. Oh, by the way, before I forget, I noticed that there was an ESCOM delegation that came to Parliament. And I think they got off lightly. You really, truly cannot argue the case for increasing tariffs by 18%. The implication of that for inflation is very, very severe. And by definition, it will push the Monetary Policy Committee to have to tighten monetary policy further. And so I think there are various ways in which ESCOM could raise funding. One from the Treasury, I don't know where the Minister has the money, I suspect he might. Secondly, by issuing bonds in the market, you know, and raise capital through that, you know. But anyway, if that's going to persist on increasing rates by 18%, I think the
the writing is on the wall for all of us. I think those are the highlights I wanted to bring out before the hand starts in second. Thank you very much.
Okay, I just hope that the statement you made earlier on is not beginning to influence the views of the other members of the MPC. Because they do not have the platform to raise their views in public. You know, they might feel that if anything happens, the territorial thing changes, then they will then say, the governor will say, I told you so. I said so in public. Okay, Mr. Mguni.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to find out from the governor. There's an increase in the issue of bonds by corporate sector, and now recently by the municipality, as they said in your document. Actually, the municipality has now issued bonds. Now, my question is, what risk does this pose with respect to financial stability? My second question is on the oil price. I think the governor will remember about 2 years ago, I asked you, what would happen if the oil price was $100 a barrel? If I remember, the response was that, well, he have increased interest rates. My question is now, in my projection, in 5 years' time, it will be double the price at the moment. Around about 2013, what is the strategy of the Reserve Bank to curb inflation or to take care of such a situation? Linked to that is that we've got the SASOL. Unfortunately, it's producing fuel from coal. What do you think is your view, or what would you propose SASOL can do in order to play a role in reducing inflation as far as fuel is concerned, because most of the oil is bought basically for fuel as such. Now, do you think that SASOL is right to continue charging the same price as if it's importing oil or it's getting oil from coal, of which the resource is in South Africa? I cannot hear your views on that. That's my first question.
Mr.
Bailey.
Thanks, Chair. Issue of oil. Though my colleague has already put that, because it's a very sensitive issue for me, very worrying indeed. One that supposed the question as the underlying reason between for these sharp increases. Yes, I do understand the on the economic report here, page 31, talking to the issue of tensions between Nigeria and Middle East, maybe for the lack of not understanding history or reading sufficiently. Maybe if the governor can advance those reasons for me or for this committee, and to further expand how bad it is, and with whatever tensions, what are we able to see any resolution or resolve to those tensions in the near future? Because according to this is linked. Or is a factor in your view in this very, very sharp price increase? That's the first one, Chair. The second one would be on the issue of interest rate high. Again, here painful as it is, but one understands the reasons advanced in relation to the ongoing interest rate hike. So the question would be, seeing that the interest rate does not, in my view, deter consumers from spending. Instead, it puts enormous pressure to more especially to the poor of our people. Is there any other alternative instrument or mechanism that can be advanced to implement the price of inflation other than interest rate? Maybe let me stop there for a bit.
Okay. Yeah, we'll take Mr. Mara. Can I just request that members be brief, because apparently almost every member has a question on this or no. If members could be very brief and Mr. Mara.
Thank you, Chair. It's obviously very difficult to be brief because it's not a brief subject. And there's a lot of concern.
It's very easy. You must be direct and to the point.
I'll try my best.
All members, before they ask questions in Parliament, they start with a statement. And unfortunately, in the committee, it's a bit different.
Governor, the first issue that I want to touch on, and I know that it's been mentioned, the things that will drive inflation, that influence inflation negatively, and we have been referred to international trends of inflation and interest rates. But I must admit, if I look at the inflation rate of our competing emerging markets in Africa, India, I mean, we are not that far off in terms of inflation. So we are not much in a negative position or worse position than they are in. Well, if you look at the interest rate, then our interest rates are relatively high. And one of the concerns is that because of the high interest rate, we draw enough portfolio investments money into South Africa, and the perception is that is required to fund the deficit on the balance of payment. And the higher our interest rate is, the more portfolio money we will draw compared to foreign direct investment, which is obviously a more sustainable way of funding that. And it seems like to somehow between monetary and fiscal policy, we don't seem to be succeeding in addressing that specific problem, and I know that has been mentioned in the MPBPS as well. Then in terms of the inflation that was mentioned and the interest rates as well, on that graph 14, the growth in loans and advances, and I know that you have mentioned that people tend to lend more, one must remember that when interest are low, banks, their accumulated profits is also lower. So they tend to instigate people to borrow more money so that they can have bigger profits for their shareholders. So it's a vicious circle that they are tend to. So it's not only the because of the consumers that spends money, it's because of the whole environment that is more conducive for them to spend money. I just want to ask a question also on the indication of consumer spending seems to be certainly it's lower. Other loans and advances have been explained to us as banks that will lend money to companies and for project finance. So in other words, that's good inflation as you've indicated. Under the installment sale and leasing finance, a large portion of that, is my assumption, is also debt to business and to companies in terms of vehicle and equipment and machinery. So again, good inflation. And if you look at that and you discount the consumer indications, all the indications that consumer is spending less. Well, and obviously the reality is that I don't think people can with the inflation that has ate all their disposable income, cannot afford to pay more interest rate. So we sit in a vicious circle, and how can we address the vicious circle? Because clearly the indicators show that fuel prices, administered prices is influencing inflation, and not those that can be managed with interest rates. There must be another way of doing that. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, you know, in Parliament, smaller parties are given, in some debates, 1 minute. 1 minute. And in that 1 minute, you know, it's not because members of Parliament can't do it. In that 1 minute, they go there and be able to deal with the subject matter. But larger parties are given longer time, and they would go there and be at leisure to go on. But it's my humble appeal, members, please. Can I request that we respond to these before we take the next lot? I have five more hands.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. The increase in bond issuance, question is, are there any risks to financial stability? I don't actually see many risks. I don't know, John, maybe you do. I don't think there are any risks. In fact, we should be happy that South Africa does have a fairly deep and growing bond market. And that's why we encourage ESCOM to go to. must go to that market, raise the capital there, spread it out over many years in terms of repayment. And I think it's good. So I'm not really worried. From that point of view, if anything, I'd like to encourage the growth and depth of that market. Incidentally, that's one of the things that is admired about the South African financial market, that we do have growing and deep bond market. It also, by the way, the other day I was asked a question when I was speaking to the Johannesburg Rotary Club. You know, Johannesburg, it's far away in the mountains, in the Popo. The members of the Rotary Club asked me to come and have dinner with them and have a conversation. I said, so what do we do? What can we do with our savings? I said, but what kind of a question is that? Buy government bonds. The most secure form of investment that you can have. It doesn't yield as nicely as some of the other assets, but it's a big asset. And I said, what do you mean? I said, well, you see, rich people boast about how much money they have in their bank account. I said, if ever you hear a rich person saying that, you must know that's a fool. You cannot boast about how much money you have in a bank account. It's a stupid thing to do. If you have any money overnight, you must put into an asset that's going to give you a yield tomorrow morning. You say, hey, I've got a nice surplus in my bank account. That's a foolish thing. And the person, if you want a secure investment, buy a government bond. It's secure. Minister Manuel is going to pay you at the end of it. And I'm really surprised that I don't know how many members of parliament, for example, have bought government bonds. You should be buying government bonds. You know? Oh. Oh, I see. Oh, sorry. I wasn't aware that you've got overdraft. If you have an overdraft, it's a bad idea to...
You mustn't have an overdraft. It's a bad idea. Yeah, but the parliament are waiting from Senegal to give them an above inflation.
Now, so I have no problem from the point of the bond issue. The oil price, in 5 years' time, the oil price might be $200 per barrel. That's possible. But outside the house, I'd like to make a bet that it might be half what it is today. And I'll give you my last cent for that bet. Should SASO not charge a domestic price instead of the global prices? I think it would be bad business for Sasol to have a special South African price. Sasol has to charge global prices. They're competing in the market with global companies, so they have to charge global prices. The argument that you're advancing, Honorable Nguni, is also could also be extended to whether South African farmers must not charge a South African price for millimeter than the one that reigns globally. Now, South African farmers are in business. Farming is a business, it's not a charity. Therefore, the maize price in South Africa has to be the global price, whether we like it or not. And the best way to avoid that is for people to start maybe, you know, growing a bit of food, maize as well at home. We're busy with land reform and so on. But in fact, there's huge tracts of land where our people are no longer farming. It's much easier to say I want a going concern from Pandemata, but at my uncle, for example, he has huge tracts of land in one of the most fertile parts of the country. And he's given me a little piece of land, and I haven't put one single millimeter there. I tried to grow avocado trees somewhere else where they died. But so there's a lot we can do to, in fact, you know, in the States, I think the Dutch Reformed Church is a very good campaign encouraging the Afrikaners to go back to the land. We need to do that now, encourage our people to go back to land and farm, work. It's very hard, it's very dirty, but we have to do it. But if whatever we produce, we have to sell abroad, it is going to have to get international prices. If we have to sell in the market, it is international prices. The notion of domestic prices doesn't work. And the notion that the government must fix the price, we have gone past those days of the maize board and the wheat board and the this board or the other board and the rugby board and so on. So I would say let's leave the competitive prices. And we know that one of the driving forces now for the maize prices in particular is, as Johan mentioned, the biofuel industry, which was, I raised that before. Incidentally, after I spoke here about the dangers posed by the biofuel industry to the maize prices, the Biofuel Development Association attacked me. And then I invited them to the bank for a meeting. And they tried to explain themselves without success. At the end of that meeting, I concluded that my position was correct, and I think they concluded that they couldn't explain themselves. Because they argued that the supply of maize for biofuel is going to increase the supply curve. You can't prove it. How are you going to increase the supply curve? It's just not right. Anyway, but I'm prepared, Honorable Nguni, to discuss this matter with you in 5 years' time when I'm very old and retired. Question number two, oil prices, what are these geopolitical reasons that we made reference of which have an impact on increasing the oil prices? It's a market field question. Whenever the market participants think that there might be some supply disruption caused by a conflict in one country or the other, so the supply and demand conditions come into play, so they think supply is going to be short, demand is going to be high. Here, the difficulties have been with local agents or local activists and, you know, people wanting, for example, for the balkanization of Nigeria, who are threatening the supply of what is called the Nigerian boni, or the oil, or the Nigerian sweet or light oil. You know, going to central banking and talking all kinds of things. And one of those sweet oil and Borneo oil and Saudi heavy and so on. All have got different prices. But eventually they come to some kind of average. Just a concern there. I read last night in one of the papers that there is some organization calling for the balkanization of Nigeria. That would be a cause of concern to the oil market, because we're no longer certain whether the supply of oil from Nigeria is going to be guaranteed. The next issue is the tensions between some of the Western countries and Iran, and the question is whether will Iranian oil still reach the market if there's a conflict. If it doesn't, what are the implications for price? So prices will go up. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of speculation out there. People are making a lot of money and others are losing quite a lot. But that's the basic approach. What can we do here in South Africa? I think it's a question that members could ask the Minister of Minerals and Energy. But my short answer is very little we can do. We are part of the global economy and we have to live by the dictates of the global economy. About interest rates, are there other tools to use in controlling inflation? I want to make a small technical differentiation between consumer spending and what can be done about it, and overall inflation and what monetary policy can do about it. I think that the focus of monetary policy is not on consumer spending as an action. The focus of monetary policy is on the overall inflation outcome, which might be influenced shortly by consumer expenditure, can be influenced by oil prices, food prices, clothing and footwear. By the way, if you look at the table on the contribution of clothing and footwear to inflation, is negative. The rate of increase in the prices of clothing and footwear is negative. Why is that the case? India and China. Major factor. Not that this one here in the case. And that's why they want so much protection. So that's because they don't want competition from China. And then they say we must have quota imports from China. Well, the producers just switched from China to Vietnam, to the Philippines. Are you going to have quota systems with everybody? You can't, clearly. I hope the Minister of Trade and Industry is not listening to this. Otherwise, I'll be in serious trouble. I might have to have lunch with him. But that's the reality of economics. You cannot have quotas with everybody in the world. But I'm saying the contribution of food, clothing and footwear is down. Now, so we have to look at the overall inflation outcome. And if that outcome shows that we need to tighten monetary policy, of course we will do. Are there any other tools of monetary policy? I have to say, regrettably, there are none. The only tool that is available for monetary policy purposes is interest rates. There's no one. The other day I was having a discussion with Buti Manamen from the Young Communist League, very bright young fellow. And he says, you must use other tools. So I said, which ones are these? There's something I missed in my economics education. What are these tools? He says, open market operation. I said, very good. At least we're going somewhere. Because open market operations are a mechanism to implement interest rates. Not the other way around. So he says, okay, why don't we try reserve requirements on banks? I said, very good. We're going somewhere. Because reserve requirements are only a means to make banks short of cash. And when they're short of cash, you who come to borrow from them will be charged a higher interest rate. What back to the same thing. So I said, what is the other one? And he says, maybe we should go and have a smoke. Because there isn't. That's the reality of the situation. But I was very happy to have such a conversation with such a bright youngster. The other, you know, question about South African interest rates being higher in comparison, maybe to India. I don't know, Malaysia or something else. But I would rather focus on what's happening in India, Brazil, China, and then Europe, which is our major trading partner. Not necessarily the US, but yeah, what's happening there. You see from the table.
In Russia.
You see from the table that interest rates in Russia are much higher than ours. And I think the inflation rate is slightly just higher. So they find that table in your system there and just left it there. Interest rates in Brazil are certainly higher than ours, even though the inflation rates are slightly lower. Interest rates in India are lower than ours, but their inflation is much, much higher. In China, inflation is relatively under control, and the interest rates are fairly under control. Interestingly, the Chinese colleagues have been clamping quite hard on liquidity in the market. And their problem is not that it's inflationary, but that there's been quite a huge inflow of capital, which is distorting the liquidity position in the market. Now, what should we be doing? I want once again draw the members' focus on the fact that we have an inflation target in South Africa of 6 to 3%. And I have always emphasized over the past 9 years I've been coming to this committee that our emphasis must not be 3 to 6. It must be 6 to 3. Declining trend, not an increasing trend. We should be much happier when inflation is around 2, is around 3%, and going down. That's much better. Because when we reach that position, it means that monetary policy can be much more accommodative than it is. That means that, you know, it's easier for people to access credit, but hopefully, I hope they pay off their debt and not just keep borrowing. And therefore, if the outlook is that we're going to be outside the target, the job of the Monetary Policy Committee is to tighten budget until we come back, and on the lower side. I would just say if we settle around, you know, 3.5% and 4%, but with a declining trend. So I just want to bring that focus back. We're really hardly in the Monetary Policy Committee think about the carry trade. That monetary policy might have an impact on the inflow of capital. We really have to think about that. And in fact, our empirical observation is that there have been times when we have increased interest rates, and in fact there's been an outflow of capital, portfolio capital. And other times when we've maintained interest rates the same, we've seen an inflow of capital. And yet, on some other occasions, when we have lowered interest rates, we have actually seen an inflow of capital, particularly into some of the sectors which are seen as likely to boost returns if one invested in the share market. For example, construction stocks. When you lower interest rates, people think that that will be supportive of the construction sector, particularly ahead of big events which are going to take place in 2010. People have invested in the retail sector, because they think lower interest rates mean that consumers will be going to spend more at Edgar's and so on, and people have been buying those stocks, Truworths, Clicks, and so on. So be careful not to mention names, because I have to mention all of them. It's not about just the credit trade on the base of interest rates. Sometimes capital has come into certain companies because of the growth story when we have reduced rates. The evidence is quite actually mixed. And why not focus more on FDI? Well, that's Minister Mpahlo's domain, and I would agree. But you know, in PE,
in PE we are now producing this horrible vehicle called the Hammer. Terrible thing. That thing is not going to make any positive contribution to global oil price decreases. It's a gambler. It's a terrible thing. And there's somebody driving that thing in Pretoria and always chasing me off the road. You know, there is this one of the PE fellows. You know, you want to boom, boom, and you want to go off the road. But that's FDI for you. The production of the Hammer in PE is good for jobs in PE, it's good for the PE economy, but it's horrible for the environment. So, the current trade really is not a major.
That's an MP's dream car.
See?
That's an MP's dream car.
I think honorable members are more environmentally conscious. And I've dealt with the issue then of consumer borrowing and low interest rates. But let me, Mr. Chairman, take advantage of this platform to raise an issue that as MPs, I think the honorable members should take this up. I am going to take it up with the commercial banks. There is something which I think is very dangerous. The commercial product, yes, I agree. It's a market issue, yes, I agree. But it's very dangerous. What happens, some commercial banks now go to pensioners and say, you have paid off your house, you have no debt at all, you have no dependents, you're a pensioner, your standard of living has come down from the days when you used to work. We as a bank want to help you to increase your standard of living. Therefore, you can use your house as a collateral. We'll then give you cash to spend every month. You know, I think you are going to do something terrible is going to happen here. Because these old people, some of them, you know, need help in terms of managing their affairs. A bank comes around and says, no, I'll give you an additional amount of money so that before you die, you live properly. Well, you might not die until you exhaust your access bond. Then they will take the house from you and sell it. And what do you leave for your children or your estate? I think that must be discouraged. And it's advertised on radio everywhere. And the old people, as I say, you know, some of them need help in managing their affairs. And they fall for this thing. So I think the MPs can help a lot. And I'll be dealing with it from a regulatory point of view. Because I can just sit around and play the role of victim when we are the regulators. So this is something like it. They won't like it. But we might be creating something that might have a financial stability implication in the future. This kind of thing. And also daylight robbery, I think. So those are would be my answers to some of the questions. But Professor, you might need to say something about some of these. No? Okay.
Okay, we'll take a 10-minute break and come back and deal with the 1,000 hands that I still have. Just 10 minutes. We'll be back here by 25. Can we do that?
Thank you, Chair. Governor, one would wish that you are not using the farm that you can send to me. Governor, you have been vocal about your advices regarding the credit commitment the population is involved in. Are we just able to indicate as to whether or not we are succeeding in sort of advising people to care from committing themselves? Secondly, Governor, we say that though the interest rates are being cut every now and again, the people continue to engage in loans. Would this perhaps not be because they are already committed and they can't get back? They are in a land of no return. Lastly, Governor, on page 14 of the review, the last paragraph, we see frequent and big fluctuations in percentages, where, for instance, we've got a decline from 8.6 to 4.9 and an increase to 7.5. What would this mean to our economy? Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr.
Finn?
Yep.
Let me just ask Johan van der Heuvel to deal with the issue of money supply. Just very quickly, he has to go to the airport. He's going to make this presentation in Port Elizabeth. He needs it to be at the airport. He's going to pee.
Will they collect you at the airport with a hammer?
If I could ask that, it deals with that question. Because, as I say, you need to go and do the MPS.
Okay, let's do that so that we can relate to your
question. Okay, thank you very much. That's a very interesting thing, and it's actually now a very widespread phenomenon. That chart showing the various growth rates is just a small extract. There are many more countries which are developing and where the growth rate in both money and credit is really on the high side at the moment. So it's a sign, perhaps, of people previously excluded from the financial system who are coming to the banking system, starting to do business, it gaining momentum. Home ownership, where it used to be state ownership, is now starting to happen for people. And so on both sides of the banking sector's balance sheet, there is quite a bit of expansion for structural reasons. At the same time, it's also fueled by commodity prices, which are favorable for many of these developing countries, which brings in more cash, and that stimulates further rounds of economic transactions and financial intermediation. So there's a fair amount, therefore, of structural change in this graph. The long term would probably be for all countries that they eventually become well-developed, mature, high levels of income, and well-intermediated, where the financial innovations then start no longer to be as strongly effective, and then there will be a loss of that momentum. But for the moment, we are in a club together with many other countries where things are very exciting and at high rates of increase, without that full high rate of increase in money and in credit being reflected in the inflation rate, because there's structural change absorbing quite a bit of the money supply increase. And I think there was, in the final question, also a more statistical matter, which, with your permission, Mr. Governor, I could just quickly deal with. It's these very choppy changes in the wages paid to people in the South African economy, if you measure it on a quarterly basis. I think the problem there is that those rates of change in remuneration and in unit labor cost and so on, based on quarterly data, well, it works on averages, and in those averages all the time there is churn. There's some companies close down, and so those people who work for them, they now suddenly fall out. Other companies start up, and then they employ other people or the same people at different wage rates, and therefore it's extremely choppy. In a way, it's both the value of the wage bill and the number of people that you divide into it that goes up and down every quarter. And so I think one should, in all honesty, smooth this a little bit and not emphasize these choppy numbers, and not, if for one quarter it goes up or down, make too much of it. One should actually probably look at a 12-month or a 24-month smooth average to do justice to.
Can I say something?
Is it a follow-up on what Johannes responded to? Okay, quickly, so that you can relate to.
isn't fair and equal. That because of commodity, and of the economic transaction, it's inevitable that the inflows, the trade money supply, in whatever way, it's beyond our control. It's not that the governor will raise interest rates, but of which it's beyond the ordinary consumer control.
Yes, to go to the airport, but it's an interesting technical discussion. The whether there is still any significant evidence, the technical level, of the what the impact of money supply is on inflation. In other words, the statistical significance of the relationship between M3 and inflation. It's a huge debate, and all kinds of econometric arguments being put across. And you've got the strict monetary, what would you say, any X percentage increase in money supply is going to lead to X percentage increase in inflation. And there are some others who say, look, I can take out M3, or money supply, from my econometric equation, and still show you that inflation is going to decline or otherwise, even if M3 is at a particular level, therefore statistically insignificant. The huge debate going on. You have the European Central Bank, for example, which is convinced that M3 is an important, a very, very significant component of the inflation process in Europe. And in order for them to maintain inflation at the harmonized index of consumer prices at around 2%. Right? They are convinced that the reference level for M3 must be 4.5%. Right? But well, life is different now. The inflation rate is at around 2%. M3 in the European, in the euro area, is well above, around 8%, thereabouts, more than double. So the statistical significance of M3, even on the HICP, is questionable. But the European Central Bank will insist that there is a close relationship. In our case, one of our researchers has been doing some work to check the statistical significance of M3 to inflation. Preliminary, early days, but he has found that it is statistically insignificant. But Johan always argues that no money, no inflation. So there's a lot of discussion ahead, even at an econometric level.
Mr. Chairman, if I could perhaps then ask to be excused, please.
Well, you are excused. The governor had already indicated thanks. Johan, I think it was. So it's good to have you here. Okay. We proceed. Mr. Singh.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Governor and Professor, for the presentation. And especially, I think, the emphasis and strong statement on the impact the electricity tariffs pricing would have on the consumer and on inflation. And also the very strong statements on food prices and food inflation and the fact that maybe we need the Competition Commission to look at other products other than bread, because we've seen since 1994 the bread pricing has been fixed, and maybe we must look at maize and other products. And what you said will help Parliament to engage with the Competition Commission. What I'd like to know, Governor, is maybe it's ignorance here. When the repo rate goes either up or down by the Reserve Bank, my understanding is that the big four banks operate independently of each other. Right, there is some relationship, but they've got different balance sheets, different profits, different things that they make. Is it necessary then for all the banks to increase their rates when the repo rates go up, or decrease when it goes down? Is it a cartel that's operating, or is it just business reasons? What are the reasons for that kind of thing? I mean, some of them give huge sponsorships and commissions on top of it, and I mean, the consumer is made to pay the price. And then what intervention can there be in that regard? Second question is, you spoke about real estate. And it's normally the middle income or upper income that are using their assets, especially houses at the moment, and then you quoted examples, to borrow. And this is having an impact on consumption expenditure. The thing is that the poor are paying the price. For the middle income and the high income who are spending more on luxury goods. And then that, I think, is the problem, because the majority of people in our country are poor. And whenever rates go up, it hurts them, because some companies, I believe, which needs investigation, would probably be artificially increasing their profit margins, riding on the back of increased transport costs, oil costs, and things like that. So just your comment on that. And then the last one, Chair, I think the Governor has actually spoken about, but maybe he can expand on the biofuel industry. I know we are in a catch-22 situation here with oil. We need oil, we need alternative energy sources and things like that. But now with the maize production probably going down, and then we're looking at food inflation, I mean, how do you balance this? Thanks.
Mr. Johnson?
Thanks, Chair. I only have one question. Maybe just and it actually relates more with the matter on low rates and more debt. I guess the question that is being asked is why, and the reason is no. Hence the point being made about a need to tighten the belt, so that when you have more debt, when the rates go down, it's time to pay. But the reality in our situation in South Africa is that when the rates go down, a number of us who would not have been able to get all what we suddenly get when the rates are down, we jump. And especially here, referring more to the middle class, somebody was telling me, working at APSA, that alone APSA would have had something like 10,000 repossessions on housing. And a month, they're looking at anything in the region of about 1,200 or so of vehicles being repossessed. Now, largely, these are people who are, middle to a higher, income groups that you are referring to. Now, the situation that I'm explaining earlier on that you are dealing with here is you are dealing with a middle class that did not have anything. Suddenly, it now has an opportunity. It rushes. Whether you like it or not, that is the reality that the middle class is confronted with. And as to how that which will then take us to the area point raised by Comrade Muloto, South Africa currently is engaged in a process of reviewing the basket. Whether that will not have any impact on the kind of issues that we are dealing with here, as we talk about the whole basket of issues that determine or that have an impact on that inflation rate we're talking about. Comment from your side on that.
Let's take responses.
Thank you very much. This has been a very useful exchange of views. I want to deal with the issue of the underlying inflation that I think Honorable Munot was also making reference to, and invite members to look at page 4 of the Monetary Policy Review, so that we can try and answer the question.
whether there are actually any major inflationary trends in the economy. And we'll also, in the process, I think, look at some tables, which is on page 3. But let's start first with figure number 3 on page 4. The red line, as we know, is the CPIX. It's trending upwards, as we can see. And we say that one of the major culprits is energy prices. So the blue line is CPIX excluding energy. And you see what happened? It's strongly on the upside. So even when you exclude petrol or energy, it's on the upside. And then the green line, CPIX excluding food, also still trending upwards. You can see that in 2007. Earlier on, it was trending downwards, but now it's trending upwards, excluding food. And then, if still we exclude food and energy, it's kind of moderating, but still above the midpoint of the inflation target. So it shows you that the underlying pressures are there, outside of food and energy. One of the economists said yesterday that I keep on saying this underlying pressures, he doesn't see the pressures. Well, here they are. And if you go back on page 3, and you see what's happening. That's table number 1, contribution to CPIX inflation. The total, as we see, in September, 6.7%, of which food is a major culture, 3.2% contribution. But so are others, housing, you know. And then there's all other kind of categories. And then there are those which are administered prices. Transport, the transport sector there is also significant, from 0.2 in August now to 0.4 is on the upside. So you can see the pressure. I wonder, I'm choppy a bit, but still on the upside. And therefore, in that context, the central bank cannot be seen to be fiddling. The document that SSA is working on to redo the basket, we're aware of it. And it's good that they must, from time to time, review the basket. For example, a couple of years ago, most of us would have bought VCR. Huh? A couple of years ago, we would have been buying the VCR. But today, you don't go to the shop to buy a VCR for a movie, you buy a DVD. So, there's clearly been technological change. And says they must move with the times. They can no longer include the VCR, really. They must now include the DVD. And then there's now iPods, and all kinds of new things which are increasingly finding themselves into the basket of commodities. So that has to be taken into account. And then you have change in the consumer pattern. You're talking about the middle class. One of the good things which has happened in the world today is a massive growth. Unfortunately, I don't have the numbers here, but a massive growth in the middle class globally. India, China, is now growth in the middle class. South Africa, Brazil, other parts of Latin America, other parts of Africa. So there's the growth in the middle class. And the consumer pattern of that middle class is almost identical to the consumer pattern of the middle class, say, in the so-called developed countries. Pushing another additional pressure on the supply of certain types of food. So it makes sense that we must look into the basket. So I very much support what SSA is doing. And I think it's quite correct. And I think we should support them and help them. They are in conversation with some of our people. They're in the process of doing this. So I think it's a good thing that they're doing. And you can see the increasing professionalism of SSA by the quality of the data that's coming out. It's very, very impressive, and I think it's one of the institutions you should really be proud of. So I'm happy about on that issue. The question that Honorable Fath is raising about the monetary policy lag, technically, our staff would argue very strongly that the monetary policy lag is 18 to 24 months. So the impact of the decisions taken today would most likely begin to be felt 18 to 24 months later. Now that's a technical argument. I always say to them, you know, these econometric models are very useful. But I know that the psychological impact of any tightening monetary policy is that afternoon. That afternoon. And you, from that afternoon, you start doing some calculations. What's going to happen at the psychological level? It hits you that afternoon, you don't wait. But the process to work things through, change in behavior, substitution effect, capital market impact, pricing impact, that works its way through the process. And technically, it's insurance. But at the psychological level, you think it happens immediately. And somebody says to me, but what's wrong with you? I say, what do you mean? I say, you're so cruel, you know? Don't you have a heart anymore? Since you went to that central bank, it looks like your heart is cold. I say, but it's got nothing to do with me. I work in a committee. So don't say me. It's the committee that's making the decisions. And the committee is implementing a mandate to keep inflation within the range. So I say, what sort of people are those? I said, well, you see them when they do monetary policy forums around the country, so you must ask them. But the key issue is that they have to focus on keeping inflation in the target range. So did the actions that we've taken so far have the necessary impact going forward? Well, we're quite convinced they will have an impact. Certainly quite much. But as I said earlier, you know, I would tighten a little bit if I was on my own. In terms of the fan chart, the critical issue there is to study the probability that's on page 33, to study the probability distribution. In other words, what is the likely chance that CPIX will return within the target at what period? I mean, at the moment, as you can see, the probability distribution that the inflation, that CPIX will be within the inflation range by the end of this year is almost about 1%. In other words, it's a 99% probability that it will be outside. Now, that says something to a central bank. 99% probability that you're going to be outside the target? Hello? Good morning. You know? So you have to do something. And then there is probably around 60% chance probability that will be within the target range in the second half of next year. So it also means that you need to do some work even as you face Christmas. So that's what I can say. Christmas at Umnavis Beach. And then on the anti-money laundering issue, there's a lot of work being done. Various agencies, in our case, it will mostly be the bank supervision department, which must ensure that there's no money laundering within the banking system. You know about the measures that have been put into place, about, you know, movement of cash, how much you deposit, why, where did it come from, that kind of thing. I think the difficult part of anti-money laundering is when people actually bring bag of money and buys a house.
That's very difficult.
So some fellow here, I think from Zimbabwe, who used to bring bags of dollars. He was building a house here in London. He lifted bags of US dollars to build a house. But then these dollars must eventually end up in the banking system because the builder wants to be paid in rand, not in dollars. And the builder takes the money to the bank to exchange for rand. And the bank says, but where did you get this money? He says, but I got it from this Minister of Finance from Zimbabwe. And the bank says, but we must check with the South African Reserve Bank whether this is correct. And we say, no, it's wrong. So we confiscate the money. Take it. It's illegal. And but that's how some of the money laundering people behave, just like that. So that we clamp down upon. And we also check through the exchange control department whether people are moving funny money around. One of the things that I always say to the Minister of Finance is that, you know, if next time in life I'm able to appoint the governor of the central bank, I'll be very careful about who I appoint. Too much power there. Because I can type your name to check how your finances are doing. Very. So you have to be very careful who you appoint to this position in the future. But for now, you're okay. I won't do that. The credit commitments by our people. I think I agree that new economic possibilities have emerged for a large number of people who were hitherto kind of in check. Now people are free, they're starting businesses. Unfortunately, they're moving out of Soweto into Bryanston. They were buying H3. They're paying off the car quicker than their house. So they pay the car off in 5 years. And the house, for some reason, in 20 years. That's strange. One is an asset that is likely to grow in value. The other one, you can smash it tomorrow. But you prefer to pay that one first than the house. Why don't you pay the house in 3 years, brother? And you know, the car, pays maybe longer. Well, much preferably. The quicker you pay both things, the better. Then you've got some savings to buy the inflation-linked bond, the government bond. Much better. But there is a temptation as well that as soon as I move out of Soweto into Bryanston, I have to, for some strange reason, demonstrate to Honorable Johnson that I'm doing much better than he. Why? Why? So, and it's a typical behavior of new money. New money which doesn't exist. Old money, people who have got money don't do that. Don't have to demonstrate to anybody anything. And so we have that difficulty, but we want to go through, I think, psychologically as a society. And I hope that members can help, honorable members can help just for us to have a conversation. The other day somebody asked me, you keep talking about this, do you have an overdraft? So I said, well, from time to time I do find myself in overdraft. And it's a bad idea. Because if you have an overdraft, say, of 10,000 rand, it means that effectively your income has declined by 10,000. And it means that next month you're going to have another overdraft of 10,000 rand and high interest. So it goes up. And that diminishes your extra income. Somebody said it's easier said than done. What do you do about it? So, well, and then there's the problem of the access bond that we talked about. The repo rate process. Why do the big four banks also increase interest rates when the repo is increased?
Well,
the basic logic of it is that all of them are now charged the same interest rate when they come to the central bank. So they've been compensated by charging the people who come and borrow from them with the population and the private companies. Why are there no competitive interest rates so that maybe one bank charges different to the other? In reality, they are competitive interest rates. In reality. Because you have to negotiate your way into this interest rate, unfortunately. So I suspect that there are very few members of parliament who are paying prime plus. I suspect that the majority of them are paying prime minus two. That's my suspicion. And if it's not the case, I think you have to go and negotiate very hard with your bank. Because they look at your credit well and assess. The unfortunate thing in a market economy is the unfortunate thing is that the poor are always paying more. So, and that's one of the problems in the U.S. subprime market. That the people who are caught up in the subprime market are the poor, who are charged prime plus, plus, plus. I pay prime minus. Just as it happens, I don't have any facility with any bank, so I don't owe them anything. But they would have charged me, I'm sure, prime minus five, because I think they like my case. But the poor people. So the issue that I've been arguing with the banks about is whether they should always maintain a margin of 3% with the repo. It's an issue that I've been unable to resolve in the past 9 years, and I suspect I might not be able to resolve it for many years until I'm 70. So that's the repo process. The issue of the middle class and upper class, I've tried to explain my way around that. But the real estate market, I'm sure the members of parliament must be very concerned about what's going on there. I think there's absolute madness there. Total, absolute madness. The Minister of Agriculture should be very concerned about what's happening. Agricultural land being turned into housing estates. What about food production? The other day I was driving on Linwood Road in Pretoria, going towards Farm Inn that way. Those who know Pretoria. I was shocked to see what has happened there. Everywhere you look, it's a housing estate. Where are the people coming from? I just couldn't believe it. And then there was two huge shopping complexes. And the parking lots were full of cars. But when do people work to earn this money that they come and spend during working hours? It's something that I think we must be very careful that we're not creating some ground for an explosion into the future. But I must say I'm very pleased about what I've seen in Johannesburg at Cosmo City, which I hope members have visited. Very encouraging. Where middle, lower, and upper classes are going to live together. It's really, that is an impressive South African construction, and I'm really encouraged that. The biofuels, what to do? Well, as I mentioned before here, I am of the opinion, fortunately it's an opinion that's shared by many other people, that for developing countries, the use of maize or corn as an input into the biofuel industry is actually negative in terms of food prices. I think we should perhaps try and use sugar cane, like Brazil is doing. And somebody's going to say, but we don't have sufficient sugar cane for biofuels. I say, well, you can buy some of the sugar cane from Cuba. It's got lots of sugar there. I'm sure Honorable Mulondo would like that, because he's a very special friend of Cuba. And as I indicated before, the use of corn by the U.S. in biofuel production has led, amongst others, to the destruction, almost near total destruction, I understand, and I stand to be corrected, of the tequila in Mexico. So the farmers are removing that plant that they used to produce tequila. And now they're planting maize because they want to export that to the U.S. Now, it's not difficult for me to imagine Mexico without tequila. The whole identity is like South Africa without the Springbok team. I mean, it's difficult to imagine that. But I've had discussions with the industry. Now, I think I've discussed this thing, Honorable Johnson, that you raised about the low rate and the tax and so on, and the need to tighten belts. And the housing repossession, and you made the example of the ASA pay. I was driving through Davidson the other day in the event. Just to see what's happening. It's, I think, was the interest of the people there. And I saw a number of houses which are slightly larger and nicer than your traditional RDP house. And I said to the person I was with, this is very good. I think we are doing a lot of good work. I said, well, the Department of Housing is doing well. He says, no, hang on, that's not Department of Housing. I said, that's an RDP house. No. That's an APSA RDP house. So I said, what do you mean? So you see, the people who live in these houses previously lived in those bigger houses over there, but then defaulted on their mortgage repayment, and they were evicted. But then the after says, you have been paying all these years. Therefore, rather than just throw into the street, move into this one that you can afford. So you're not thrown out into the street. And I thought that was a very good thing. Don't throw people into the street. You afford them the opportunity to move into a house that they can afford. And you take account of all the repayments which they've done over the years in moving them to this. I thought that was a good thing. And I thought if all the banks could do that, things would be progressing. They say, some humility and humanness to it. We won't. They don't throw people into the street. So, and I hope that many other banks could do that, and I think it's good. And I think we should congratulate absolutely for doing that. I'm not congratulating them for the fucking sponsorship, but at least for this. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thanks, Governor. I see there are still a lot of further questions. But Governor, a simple question. On page 21 of the annual economic report, you refer to the business cycle developments and say this has been the longest upswing. Page 21 at the bottom, and it goes on to page 22. And the way the report raises it is like this extraordinary length of the current upswing is at least partly related to the fact that it coincided with the structural improvement in our rate of economic growth. Are you anticipating that, as is always the case, these upswings do not last forever? Is this a warning that we are likely to see? I see there are a number of positives coming up, but an upswing, you say it's the longest since the one from September 1961 to April 1965. This time around, it's about 44 months now. But also you and on page 27 you talk about the domestic agricultural fruit product prices having increased, mainly over the past 18 months following unfavorable weather conditions. Does this then justify the high rate of the agricultural products that you yourself have indicated that you're unhappy about? My last third one is on page 26 on consumer price inflation. On that graph, the difference between the percentage change in headline CPI and CPI-X looks quite erratic. At some point, the headline CPI was, between 2003 2004 at its lowest. I mean, the percentage change was at its lowest, while the CPI-X was quite high. And if you move to 2007, the opposite. Can you explain that graph for my benefit? Mr. Mlotho.
Two quick ones. I've read recently, I think it was in the financial mail, and they were citing the Bank of International Settlements as their source. They are saying that South African bond market is much weaker than even those of some developed countries. I just want to find out from the governor, what are the reasons that make South African bond market to be that weak? Though they indicate also that the corporate bonds are not that liquid, but they're saying the general trend, not just confined to South Africa, the general global trend. I just want to establish why. It's a good story. I just want to establish what are the factors that are influencing this good story. My second question is on the ICBC Standard Bank story. Governor, from a slightly different direction, I just want to establish whether in your projections within the bank, whether dividend payouts are not going to lead to the deterioration of the current account.
Thank you. With reference to the question made of food products, I remember that when we had our last engagement, we requested that the government attend to commission a research around this issue. And the committee is now quiet as well as the governor around that. I think now the buzzword, we should stop now to have a buzzword of 2010. The real buzzword should be global warming, which is the province I'm coming from. Northern Cape is being hardly hit now by this thing of global warming. And I think that we as South African and the world, we have to look into that and check whether is it going to really affect, because the farmers now in Northern Cape are starting to rethink and redefine their role in the farming. How is it going to hit the ordinary people on the ground? The second question, Chairperson, is around the statement made by the governor in terms of comparison in inflation targeting rate with reference to Africa and so on in South Zimbabwe. My question is this a fair analysis? Because some other African countries are depending on loans and donor funding and so on. If they default, what will happen? For now, it's still Zimbabwe. Then, therefore, I want to check whether this is fair comparison with reference to that. The last one, how is it in terms of our currency? When you look, there was a problem of the counterfeit. Because one would be worried if the counterfeits are still there on the street. If they are there on the street, how far are we going in terms of trying to curb that? And is there any success rate in terms of that. What are you saying on that one? Thank you, Captain.
Yeah, Mr. McCarter.
Thank you, Captain. Governor, I just want to raise a few questions. I think some of the questions that I wanted to raise have been asked already. But I just wanted to check, from what you have highlighted, you have said that you have only one tool. But I suppose that there might be a solution somewhere, because also as government, we've got a role to play in terms of ensuring that people still live better, even though the inflation will still exist. But from the point of view of government, I want to check what is your view in terms of actions that can be taken by government to ensure that while inflation exists, people, especially the poor, still have a plate of food on their table. the second question, Chairperson, relates to the issue of the U.S. economy. I want to check with you, the Governor, whether this sluggish growth in the U.S. economy is a deliberate move by the U.S. government to deal with other internal issues of that we are not aware of, or it's something that happened out of market reaction. The last question relates to, you know, I'm a layman in economics, layperson. I'm then tied in with, I'm not thinking about men, but
That's okay. One member in parliament referred to herself as when she was a little boy.
But I'm part of the mankind. Chairperson, I wanted to check with the Governor if, as the Reserve Bank, are there any potential threats or risks to the international liquidity position of South Africa, and I think I'm gonna stop there. These three questions. Thanks.
Okay, can we perhaps deal with those?
Thank you very much. Business cycle indeed has been the longest. As we have seen, I think the last quarterly bulletin, if I'm correct, could have tried to indicate some of the technical changes to the components of the business cycle indicators which were published. It is true that we've had the longest upward trend in the business cycle, the leading indicator and so on. Part of the explanation might be that, we have come out of a kind of closed economy, now into the more open economy. And the items such as business confidence, and so on, have really shown quite a positive trend. Does it mean this is going to last forever? The answer is no. It won't last forever. Business cycles go down and up. So that's what they call cycles. Go up and down. We, at the moment, we're likely to be living in a good cycle. I was saying to the Secretary Kanya for the other day, which I think I said it here another time, I said, it might not be a bad idea for you, myself, and Brian Mulisa to retire gracefully from our roles, you know. So he says, why? He said, you wanna. I said, you know, so that we can say during the time when the Limpopo Nostra was in charge, there was high economic growth.
And he said we were going nowhere, we were staying here. We have a lot of work to do.
Now, the agricultural production. There's no doubt that the agricultural contribution to GDP has been shrinking. And we really need to pay attention to that as a country. And I think the responsible people, particularly the Minister of Agriculture, really must look closely. We're really taking things for granted. It will come back and haunt us in years to come. Really, truly speaking. In the process, we are losing a lot of agricultural skills. Because, you see, agriculture is a big business, as old man Fansale used to say. You know old man Fansale from ZZ2, the biggest tomato grower in the country. He passed away, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. He used to say, this is not part-time thing. This is a business. You must handle it as a business. And as I say, I've learned the hard way trying to plant avocado seeds. It's not something that you do over the weekend when you're tired of monetary policy and you go off and plant avocados. You have to look after this tree. There's a lot of science that goes into it. And we have to protect the agricultural land that we have. We have to continue training people. We have to continue ensuring that the water resources necessary for agriculture are there. And all the training in agricultural colleges. You know, today, if you said somebody goes to an agricultural college, they think that you're wasting their time because they want to go BE. But you have to go to the agricultural college to be able to grow avocado trees, to be able to look after them and to harvest and to sell to the market. To grow avocado trees, you must know that you'll only harvest in 7 years or 10 years. It's a long-term investment. It doesn't happen tomorrow. So it's like, so, yes, I'm concerned about it, and I think we can do a lot of work to still increase the potential for agriculture. And agriculture can employ lots of people. But I think that the problem that we've had is that because of the Group Areas Act, and people feeling that they were confined maybe to the countryside, and there's also a negative connotation related to being in the countryside. They don't even call it countryside, they call it rural areas. And then there's expressions like, you are so rural. I mean, when they say you are so rural, it's like you're walking around wearing animal skins. And, then when you go to Joburg, it's all Ujim comes to Joburg from the rural area. I mean, from Askukuni, there's some negativity that's attached to the countryside, which is wrong. It's absolutely wrong. We should encourage people to work in agriculture, to be productive. As I say, you know, my uncle gave me this little piece of land and I didn't put one tree there. I should go and grow something there. He has, as I say, 90% of his land, which is fertile for agriculture, is just lying fallow. And he says, I can only work on this part. So he produces bananas, he produces mango, he produces some of the largest cabbages I've seen. But he says, I can't work on this. My children are not interested. But meanwhile, the bees will then clean somewhere. But you must come and plant here. They don't want to work. Anyway, let's leave that aside. CPI and CPIX, the trends, very erratic. Indeed, they are. The key thing that we need to watch out for is what is the core inflation rate. Also, from the headline inflation rate, you should try and remove food and energy and other volatile elements to get a sense of the core inflation rate. But we must remember that CPI in particular is influenced to a larger degree despite the actions of the central bank. When interest rates are going down, CPI is likely to go down. When interest rates are going up, CPI is likely to go up. So it's a bit choppy. To a large extent, energy, food, interest rates are very critical in the behavior. But let me move very quickly before I meet my slides. Bond market liquidity, why is that the case? Well, I think South Africa among emerging markets has a very strong financial market structure. And this did not happen by chance. It's been consistently driven by policy decisions. And no matter what we might say about our predecessors, but one of the good things they did was to begin the process of growing the capital market in South Africa. And when the new government came into power in 1994 and we introduced a system of primary dealers in the market, in particular in government bonds and so on, that helped to grow the market. So it's been a systematic task which has led to a situation where not only do we have a significant government bond market, but we have a significant corporate bond market. Most of the corporates have come into the market and they've issued bonds, raising capital. The parastatals have done so. And for the parastatals, it was very important for them to be involved in the bond market because they reduced their dependence on the fiscus and the raising cash from the market, which is what I think ESCOM should do. Now, go to the market and raise. And I think Transnet, they just issued a bond recently, and it seems it was well subscribed to. Some of the big municipalities, metros, issue bonds, like the Jersey bonds, which I hope members of parliament are buying because it's a good way to invest. That's flinging money overnight in the bank account. And then there's been an interest from non-residents to buy into the corporate bonds as well. And then we have somebody called the Japanese housewife question. They call them urindashi bonds, which is a savings scheme, which is mostly subscribed to by indeed the Japanese housewives. And they also issue in rand. Maybe when we've got time, next time we can explain why. Because of the depth of this bond market, it has become too attractive to many actors. Of course, it is true in the case of Japan that people have been borrowing in the Japanese market in order to invest in high-yielding markets. I was being one of them because interest rates in Japan are just too low. So it's easy to borrow there and invest in the U.S., in South Africa, in Brazil, or those areas where the market permits. But so given the structure that we have created, it has become very attractive for people to invest here. It's not as easy to invest in some markets. And I'm not criticizing my colleagues who I'll be having a meeting with from Friday, but it's very difficult to invest in the India bond market, for example, because of the rules and regulations, or in Russia, or, you know, very difficult. So we do provide an atmosphere where there's a lot of interest. Let me leave that there. The ICBC 20% stake in Standard Bank, that's still a subject, I think, of approval, not by the register of banks, but by the shareholders of Standard Bank. I think it's a good thing. I think it will help to cement the relationship between China and South Africa. So it's a political relationship, but in the economic relationship, I think it's going to be strengthened. Does it mean that there's a sign out there that says South African bank for sale? The answer is no. South Africa has to maintain its own strategic banking interests. So we are not selling our banks. And we make it very clear that the ICBC is only allowed to purchase 20% up to 20.5% in Standard Bank. Why do we did we put the 0.5? Just in case there's some fluctuations in the market, you know, you must give that room for maneuver. Not more. And it's clear, don't come back to the South African Reserve Bank and ask to increase your stake, because it will chase you away. You might even have to hire some dogs to bite you. Does it mean that other banks are for sale? No. We have to maintain a strategic South African economic interest. Otherwise, you know, the country might be for sale. And in that regard, I very much appreciate the statement issued by Mr. Jim Sutcliffe of Old Mutual that Nedbank is not for sale. I hope he's going to live by that for generations to come. So, the issue of South African of dividend outflows, when is that going to happen? By definition, when people have bought in South African companies, they have the dividend outflow. And the key strategic interest for South Africa is encouraging South African companies to also invest abroad so that dividends can flow back this way to counteract the outflows, to improve the situation on the current account of the balance of payments. Very quickly, the issue of the research program that is there on food prices is a pity that the head of research has left. But they are in progress. But you know, central bank researchers, they want to cross the T's and dot the I's. They don't want to bring anything to the governor which is not super perfect in their view, just in case the governor complains. They're very good people. They don't like the governor to be upset. Because they say, when I'm upset, I'm grumpy. And they don't want a grumpy central bank governor. Apparently, it's a bad idea. And I would agree with them. Now, Chief, can I give you a crazy idea? The Northern Cape. And it's a crazy idea that in future might work. How do we fight against the encroachment of the desert? You can't sit around and just go to church and pray. You've got to do something about it. And you can learn examples from countries such as Israel about how to fight the desert. And turn what looks like an unproductive land into productive land. We can do that. There's water being wasted in the Okavango, Bango area there, parts of Botswana. Why can't it be diverted that way? If we can move water from the islands of Lesotho into the Vaal Dam, far away, there's no reason why we can't move water from the Shoms there into the Northern Cape. And I think those of you who come from KwaZulu-Natal or have visited the Drakensberg, they would take water from the Tugela into the Vaal. One of the best engineering outcomes that I've ever seen. To pump water across the Drakensberg and into the second dam, is it? Yeah. It's wonderful human achievement. So there it is for another case. I think it's possible, Chief. It's very possible. So don't complain, do something. Now, inflation in Africa, I think there have been major achievements, and I just want to record that. It's a pity that when we talk about Africa, we don't highlight these major economic achievements which have been made. Because the headlines are always focusing on the negatives. The fighting some general, somebody in the Eastern Congo is fighting somebody because they want mineral resources. There's an outbreak of this disease or the other in Africa. Inflation is too high in Zimbabwe, and so on. But there are so many positives. I mean, look at Angola, for example. After the peace that has been achieved there, the rate of growth is so impressive. Look at Tanzania, what's happening there. Look at Botswana. Look at Zambia. You look at in Malawi. You raise an important issue about donor assistance, which I agree with you. I think Africa must move more and more away from dependency on aid. And One of the interesting things which I think over the past 9 years I raised here is the issue of collecting tax to fund the budget. Collecting tax is very difficult. You have to enforce it. And one of the things that we must never let go in South Africa is that SARS, together with the National Treasury, has made the culture of paying tax so attractive. You feel good that you're paying tax. It's good. You know, when the deadline for paying your income tax arises, you see the queues that are out there. And what has been more encouraging for me is the percentage of black people choosing to pay tax. It's just unbelievable. They voluntarily now want to pay tax, which is a good thing. We're making progress, including the taxi drivers and the taxi owners. Now, not you. Which is good. I think it's a good thing. We must protect and, I think, promote that and to avoid. And I think most of our colleagues in Africa can learn from this. The last issue about monetary policy tools, well, just to re-emphasize that really there isn't any other tool really except interest rates. What about the poor? Well, the poor actually suffer most when inflation is high. The rich really hardly feel it. You know, they buy boats that they put there in the waterfront, they buy land, whether in Kenya or somewhere else, they buy large houses in golf estates, they put their money in government bonds, they take their money to New York or London. But my mother cannot do that. She relies on that stipend that she receives from her late husband's estate. My father was a good man. He left a pension for my mother. And she still lives on it. But what if inflation goes higher? That pension becomes meaningless for her. Not for me. Not for members of parliament. But for her as a poor person. So that's why I the other day I gave a speech and said that, you know, I hope that one day the Savior movement is going to print t-shirts and say, viva low inflation, viva inflation target. Because low inflation is good for the working class. It's actually good for the working class. So I think the poor will benefit when we have really conquered the war against inflation. The U.S. economy, slightly growth. It's a deliberate effort. No, it's not. It's not. There's absolutely no conspiracy in that regard. It's just a cyclical thing. It's also the timing of interest rate movements in the U.S., but also the behavior of the global economy. The U.S. dollar maybe for a while might have been too strong and might have had some impact on the export sector, even though that's coming out gradually. I think though, what is that expression in Italian? It's called look west, sun. Maybe the view should be look east, sun. Because the real issues are in India, China, and the east. That's where the real game is now for economic growth. I was in India 2 weeks ago and I tell you things that's happening. As my kids will say, it's happening. Threat of liquidity issues for South Africa. Well, so far I think only one bank has announced that they're going to have to write off a few million rand as a result of their small exposure to the subprime issues. So from what I know today, I think the South African banking sector is really fairly safe. But I must emphasize, on the basis of what I know today, because I've learned that what you know today might change tomorrow. But on what I know, and based on the report I've received from the Register of Banks, they would not have any major liquidity exposure to the subprime. So we shouldn't be concerned. Now, but as we know, we have learned to say that you must never be over emphatic on things. Just like as I said earlier, I said, you know, if the MPC was composed of one person, they would be tightening the man's support. But the MPC is made up of many other people. They might argue differently. And I hope to persuade them, but they might persuade me. So one must never be too dogmatic about it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I very much enjoyed our interaction.
Yeah. Members, we've come to the end of the session. I see that there were still people that wanted to ask questions. If we did that, we're not going to finish at all. We'll find another time with the governor. Yeah.
I just want to find out if I can go into a joint venture with the governor.
On avocados or on the...